From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hey, Kojo.
For our last show of the year, we're doing something a little bit different. We'll be taking a look at the big political stories of 2021, as well as what's ahead for 2022. And a quick note before we get started, this show has been pre-recorded, so we won't be taking listener calls, tweets, or emails. Joining me are three people who cover regional politics every day. Martin Ostermuhl is a reporter for WAMU and DCist covering DC politics. Martin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Danielle Gaines is the editor-in-chief of Maryland Matters. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
And Laura Vozella is a reporter covering Virginia politics for The Washington Post. Laura, thank you for joining us.
Sure thing.
Before diving into the conversation, let's look back at some of the big moments in local politics over the past year. We captured many of them right here on the Politics Hour. Congressman Raskin, let's start on January 6th, the day of the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol.
It was an hour or two of true terror there.
I am still just furious about it. I am furious that we had a president who incited it.
The stain of this moment and the damage done will be long-lasting.
The Virginia General Assembly recently voted to abolish the death penalty.
You know, the most recent Gallup polling shows that now 45% of Americans are morally opposed to capital punishment.
Okay, let's talk about the coronavirus vaccine.
Our team thinks at some point we're no longer going to be talking about how we don't have enough vaccine. So we'll be moving from a supply problem to making sure we have a focus on demand.
For the second year in a row, Democrats in the House of Representatives have passed a D.C. statehood bill. This time around, however, it's likely to get a hearing in the Senate.
Governor Larry Hogan this week announced that he's launching a $2 million lottery that's going to hand out dozens of cash prizes, $40,000 a pop, and a big grand prize of $400,000 to people who haven't gotten vaccinated yet.
Well, people have reported major problems with applying for unemployment insurance.
The District of Columbia has really seen over a 300% increase in initial claims filing from pre-pandemic years.
Former Carlyle Group executive Glenn Youngkin won the party's nomination for governor.
Well, he's definitely a true political outsider.
I don't think it was a surprise that Terry McAuliffe, the former governor, won the nomination.
A slew of new laws went into effect in Virginia July 1st, including the start of a complicated multi-year marijuana legalization process.
But we're seeing more and more saturation of gun carriers in our city. And when that happens, you're going to have more shooting and, unfortunately, more homicide.
How concerned should Virginians be about the Delta variant?
Well, I would be very concerned, Kojo.
And it's time to get our students back into school. It's been too much time away, and many of our students have been learning remotely over the past 18 months plus.
The 7,000 series strains make up 60% of Metro's fleet, so pulling them out of service has had major impacts.
The National Transportation Safety Board Chairman Jennifer Homendy said this week, this could have resulted in a catastrophic event.
The Loudoun County School Board meetings have become the center of a contentious debate over how we teach race.
So you won't find a critical race theory 101 listed as a course, but when teachers are being taught to communicate this to children in all sorts of different contexts, then it certainly is there.
Republicans won big this week, winning the three statewide positions and flipping at least five seats to the Virginia House of Delegates.
The Republicans went into the race assuming that they could turn out a significant number of those voters who voted in 2020, and they succeeded.
So earlier this week, the Prince George's County Council voted to approve a new map. Some residents are calling an example of gerrymandering.
We're not necessarily done with Delta, but we've got a new variant. Omicron has arrived in the United States.
Thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Those were some of the big stories we covered here on the Politics Hour. Martin Ostermuhl, I'll start with you. The first major event of the year happened right here in Washington, D.C., the Capitol insurrection on January 6th. Can you first remind us of what happened that day?
I mean, in short, I think we all remember the day that some very fervent supporters of former President Donald Trump took things a little too far. And, you know, some would say they were just tourists visiting the Capitol. Others would say that there were people who stormed the building, participated in a riot or an insurrection. But essentially, they were trying to stop the counting of the electoral votes. They succeeded for a couple of hours. They forced lots of police officers to respond in a very aggressive manner. And generally speaking, scrambled American politics in a lot of very complicated ways.
What were the big implications for the District of Columbia?
Well, I think one of the main ones, first of all, was you literally had residential areas that were within a couple blocks of the Capitol. So you had people who live in the district, who make their lives in the district, who were listening and experiencing firsthand what they thought was violent insurrection in the nation's capital. So that's scary, number one. Number two was the fact that the district's police force, the Metropolitan Police Department, was essentially responsible for saving the capital. U.S. Capitol Police were overrun quickly. The D.C. National Guard took hours to get there for complicated reasons. MPD sent 850 police officers there. They literally fought, they went toe-to-toe with some of these folks, and there was lots of injuries and whatnot. And then beyond that, there's lots of complicated questions, or not so complicated questions, about the district status. It's not a state. The mayor has no control of the National Guard. So when she wanted the National Guard to help respond to the Capitol, she had no authority to call them out. She had to rely on the president of the Department of Defense to do so, and they apparently didn't do so for many hours.
I'm sure you are a resident analyst, so I'm looking to you for some analysis of this. I know for me, like many residents of the district, it was personal.
Well, yes, if you live here in our voteless status, the fact that Martin mentioned that the mayor cannot call out the National Guard, she alone, all the governors of the states can call out the National Guard. Here you have to go to the Secretary of the Army to get the National Guard called out. And that the whole thing of what happened on January the 6th is still playing out in the federal courts and in the halls of Congress about exactly what happened. But what happened was the people of the District of Columbia were badly served by the insurrection. I'll call it an insurrection.
Yep, sir.
Because that's what it was.
Metropolitan Police Department Chief Robert Conti had taken over as chief of the department just days before this insurrection, Martin. How did his department handle things as they unfolded that day?
I mean, like I said earlier, they get a lot of credit now for the fact that they were first on the scene. I mean, Capitol Police was there, obviously, because that's their job. They were overrun. The first calls went out to MPD, and there's even stories of MPD officers commandeering Metro buses and just hightailing it to the Capitol. And once they got there, basically just taking up positions and fighting off some of these insurrectionists. There was police officers who showed up who weren't even called out to be there. They just decided that this is something they need to do as police officers. Like I said, 850 officers. The city estimated it cost about $10 million just in the cost of getting police officers there. And that also means police officers were not out in the city doing their jobs. They were injured thereafter. They were probably kept on leave for a while. So I think, the police department performed well and was impacted pretty severely after the fact.
On the day of that event, I was sitting at home in Southwest Washington, saw what was happening on TV, and of course I went up there and I stood on the east side of the Capitol. I did not go inside to get a sense of who the hell are these people who are, violating, breaking the windows and all of that. And some people were standing around looking aghast at what was happening. Others were laughing and talking, and others were waving Trump flags. It was an extraordinary event in our American history, let alone D.C. history.
I gotta say, January 6th highlighted that the mayor does not have control of D.C.'s National Guard, which led to a delayed response from that unit. I know there was a bill in Congress, Martin, to put the Guard under mayoral control. Where does that stand now?
Well, it doesn't stand anywhere. That bill passed, I think it was this month, and they took that provision out. So the overarching control of the National Guard still resides in the president or the Department of Defense, the Secretary of the Army. Now, they did expand it. They gave the Capitol Police the power to call out the National Guard. So imagine that. You can have the federal government can call out the National Guard in the district. The Capitol Police can call out the National Guard, but the city's mayor can't.
And this was, of course, January 6th, both a national, well, even international and regional event. So, Danielle Gaines, I'd like to hear your take on it from the Maryland perspective.
Well, I think the biggest thing that came out of it from the Maryland perspective is really what happened afterwards, where you had Maryland Representative Jamie Raskin leading the subsequent impeachment proceedings. Which occurred in very short order after the insurrection. And, he became a national name. And part of just the extraordinary nature of him taking on that role is that, of course, his son had died just prior, and his family was still very much in grief. He brought members of his family, one of his daughters and one of his sons-in-law, with him to the Capitol on that day. And he was fearful for them the whole time this was happening. And, you know, there was a really beautiful story just written in the Washington Post about how intertwined his child's death and the insurrection became for him, and they're kind of guiding who he is now as a person.
Jamie Raskin continues to be involved in the House investigation of what exactly happened there, so we'll be hearing a lot more from him in the coming year.
Yeah. On the Republican side, at least one Maryland lawmaker was at the rally outside of the Capitol on that day, Maryland State Delegate Dan Cox. Why is that now important?
So current delegate and gubernatorial candidate Dan Cox was present at the rally that preceded the traveling to the Capitol and the breaking down of barriers. He has said that it was cold and the groups from Frederick County went home early on chartered buses and that he was not a part of the insurrection. But while the group was banging down doors and attempting to gain access to the Capitol, he did tweet that Mike Pence is a traitor, the former vice president. So he was certainly adding fuel to...
That's likely to follow him in this gubernatorial campaign. Yeah.
Let me ask about that, because, you know, Governor Hogan has said of Dan Cox, calls him a QAnon whack job. Governor Hogan can speak fairly clearly when he wants to. What is the sense that Dan Cox can move outside of his district in Frederick and make a statewide run?
I think, you know, he's definitely moving about the state. He's definitely moving around his district and going for a statewide
run. He's anti-mask. He questions the virus.
Yes.
It's really hardcore right wing. I'm just wondering how he can pull together the Republican Party of Virginia, let alone the state, given that it's like someone like Hogan is much more middle of the road conservative.
Yeah, he's certainly going to try. Obviously, in Republican quarters, there. These messages resonate with a lot of people. But we've also seen that Republicans are really proud and they stand behind Governor Larry Hogan, who did, you know, denounce the insurrection, who did send National Guard troops, who did denounce this message, this tweet of Mike Pence being a traitor.
Kelly Schultz, who's a commerce secretary, she's running for governor and seen as the kind of institutional Republican candidate. How is that working out at this moment? In contrast to Cox,
yeah,
the QAnon whack job.
Yeah, she's also, I mean, they're both holding fundraisers. They're both holding events. You know, I asked Kelly Schultz in one of our interviews during her race, like, what would you do as governor? And she's like, I'd do exactly what we're doing right now. Like, I'm in Larry Hogan's cabinet and I'm happy with how things are going. But, you know, Republican primary voters are not the same electorate that has elected Republican Governor Larry Hogan. So, you know, who knows what might happen in the primary.
I think Sherwood just likes repeating QAnon whack job.
It has a certain ring to it. Ring in the new year. I'll keep ringing that name.
Laura Vazella, how did Virginia Governor Ralph Northam respond to the January 6th insurrection in terms of aiding the Capitol? And what was the response from the state's Republican Party?
Well, Northam got a call from Nancy Pelosi directly amid all the turmoil, and she asked him for help. He sent state troopers who were among the first on the scene. He also called up the Guard. They needed Defense Department approval to have the Virginia Guard cross the state line.
Allow me to interrupt for a second. Did she make that call in part because of the slow response of the D.C. National Guard?
Well, I can't say for sure, but she called out and saying that, Ralph, there's, you know, we need help. So whether she realized, I don't know if she knew what was happening with the D.C. Guard, but it was clearly an all hands on deck kind of moment. And he didn't have the power to send in the Guard across state lines without the Defense Department approval, but he got them called up and massed near the line, and then by the time they were ready to roll,
he had the Defense Department approval. Hearing the response, or Larry Hogan's response, makes me realize how different Virginia Republicans are from Larry Hogan and maybe most Maryland Republicans. The governor's race was just in its earliest stages at that point, and most of the Republican nominees, if not all, were running against the rioting and social justice protests of the previous summer. And so they were complaining about woke mobs. And when this happened, some of them put out statements saying, you know, we don't condone this violence. And the Republican chairman at the time, well, he's still the chairman, but at the time, Rich Anderson initially put out a statement condemning this. And he ended up having to pull that back about a day later. He got so much pushback from Republican chairmen around the state that he put out a letter a day or two later saying, I've since received information that this was really QAnon that crashed the Capitol. And so, you know, this will need to be investigated. And it just shows you how much the Republican Party in Virginia is in the thrall of Trump. And even after that episode, of the seven Republicans who were running for the nomination for governor, two would acknowledge that Biden had been legitimately elected. So there was no break with the big lie or anything of the sort. And those two did not fare well in the nomination process.
Laura, Glenn Youngkin won, he's going to be sworn in as governor in a couple of weeks. What did he actually say? Did he actually condemn the rioting? I can't recall exactly what he said during the campaign.
You know what? He wasn't officially in the race yet. He didn't declare until late January. He has said subsequently that he condemns violence in all its forms, but he would not acknowledge that Biden was legitimately elected for the first 4 months of his campaign. Then after sewing up the nomination, he said, of course he was legitimately elected, but he still pushed, you know, the need for greater election integrity, you know, in a state that Biden won by 10 points, and even the Trump campaign hadn't suggested had anything amiss on Election Day.
That's the voice of Laura Vozella, a reporter covering Virginia politics for The Washington Post. In case you're just joining us, we're recapping the events of the year 2021 in politics and taking a look forward to 2022 with Martin Ostermuller, reporter for WAMU and DCist covering DC politics, and Danielle Gaines, the editor-in-chief of Maryland Matters. Of course, Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. The reason you don't hear me giving out the phone number is that this is a pre-recorded conversation, so we won't be taking any calls or tweets or emails. Danielle Gaines, let's jump into the legislative milestones of the year, starting with Maryland, where Democrats control the House of Delegates and State Senate. What were the big issues they tackled?
You had a lot of reform efforts, really, and multi-year reform efforts. So early in the legislative session in February, you had a vote to override Governor Larry Hogan's veto of an education reform plan. That education reform plan was controversial, I mean, mostly for its cost, but it will pump, you know, billions more into state education funding over the next 10 years from the state and from local governments. And it will do things like expand pre-kindergarten. It will direct additional funding to schools that have high concentrations of poverty. One of the things this reform panel really looked at was the difficulties that you face in a school where, you know, one out of 10 children face poverty and kind of the institutional supports that they end up having around them versus the difficulty that's faced by a school that has 9 out of 10 children living in poverty. So it's a rethinking of the school education funding formula and a rethinking of how we pay educators. It will increase the salaries for teachers dramatically over the next 10 years.
There was also major police reform legislation, but
yeah.
Maryland lawmakers also voted to repeal the state song, Maryland by Maryland, which refers to Abraham Lincoln as a tyrant.
I was just interested that the vetoes, the Maryland legislature is in the process of overturning any number of vetoes, and there will be more in the coming year. I think what tells us is that Adrian Jones, the speaker, and Bill Ferguson, the president, have really gotten control of the state legislature, a united Democratic Party, which some of the Democrats around the country and nationally should look to get a lot of things done, despite Hogan's popularity among the people. The legislature is its own place.
Let me bring back Laura Vazell in the conversation, because, Laura, this was the second year the Democrats in Virginia had the trifecta control of the governorship and both chambers in the legislature. That's about to change. But the General Assembly passed a slew of legislation in 2020, raising the minimum wage, gun control, expanding access to abortion. What did they get done this year?
They got two things done that were huge. However, compared to their first year in the having, the, as you called it, the trifecta, it almost seemed like a quiet year. But they fully legalized recreational marijuana, and they abolished a death penalty. And the, just to show you the dramatic change for that death penalty measure to pass, just a few years prior, Republicans had passed legislation to bring back the electric chair as the default means of execution. So that's a 180 change. However, you put it in the context of the prior year, where there were gun restrictions, they passed gay rights legislation, eased access to abortion, to voting. It's been a revolution over those 2 years, really. And now we'll see whether that's reversed. I kind of doubt that. I think we'll see more tinkering around the edges with kitchen table tax and education and business regulation type, environmental regulation type things for under Youngkin, despite the fact that his base very much would like him to push the gun and abortion issues that really he pushed during the nomination battle.
And we'll talk more about that later. But Martin, since we've talked about marijuana legislation, that's been a priority for D.C. lawmakers for some time now. Marijuana is legal in D.C., but there's a catch. You can't buy or sell it. And that also means it can't be taxed. So what's next?
Well, I think this is a good segue from Virginia, because I think it's fascinating now that in the D.C. region, you may well have Virginia and Maryland actually jump ahead of the district when it comes to marijuana legalization. For Maryland, maybe not that surprising. For Virginia, it's just an utter shock, because I remember I was there a couple of years ago talking to marijuana advocates. And at that time, they were just hoping for medical marijuana. They were hoping for some semblance of a program, just because it was much more conservative. But yeah, the district, you know, if you can carry small amounts of marijuana, you can grow it in your home, you can use it in your own home, you can gift it to people, but you can't sell it. And that's a big issue for the district. And they're trying to change that.
You can't get revenue from it.
Right, exactly.
Going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation on the political happenings in the year 2021 in the Washington region. We're talking with Martin Ostermuller, a reporter for WMU and DCS covering DC politics, Laura Vazella, reporter covering Virginia politics for the Washington Post, and Danielle Gaines, editor-in-chief of Maryland Matters, our resident analyst, is Tom Sherwood, who's also a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back to this conversation about the political happenings in this region during the year 2021. We're talking with Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Danielle Gaines is the editor-in-chief of Maryland Matters. Martin Ostermuller is a reporter for WAMU and D.C. is covering D.C. politics. And Laura Vazella is a reporter covering Virginia politics for The Washington Post. When you took that break, Tom Sherwood, you were talking about marijuana and D.C. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to add.
Well, it just, as I blurted out at the end there, the fact is the big issue for the district, unlike Colorado and other states where marijuana is legally sold, is the district cannot benefit from it. There's no tax money coming from it. And the city could use that money in any number of different ways.
And just real quick, I think the one thing I should have mentioned, which is critical here, is that the reason that the district has not legalized and it's put it behind states like Maryland and Virginia that could do it more quickly is that Congress hasn't allowed the district to do it for the last 6 years. there was hope that Democrats in the House and the Senate would lift that prohibition, but it hasn't come to pass. It's just gotten bumped down the road. At this point, the earliest it could happen is early next year, may not happen then. And then if Republicans take the House and the Senate next year, it could well stay in place for another 2 years after that. So who knows when this could happen?
Delegate Ellen Holmes Norton is really pushing this as one of the things that will help the district. There's great fear among the Democrats that the Republicans will take the House back in 2022, and a lot of hopes for the district. Even statehood and then on down won't happen.
And this is because of what's known as the Harris Rider. Is that not correct?
Exactly. Representative Andy Harris from the 1st District in Maryland, the one Republican in the congressional delegation and a very Republican, who has made it kind of a point to pick on the district when it comes to marijuana legalization and imposed this prohibition in 2015 after D.C. voters voted to legalize possession.
But Democrats in Maryland had other plans for Harris, did they not, Tanya?
Yeah, they do. Well, just recently the state legislature met to pass a new congressional district plan that basically it changed Representative Harris's district to cross over the Chesapeake Bay Bridge and include a part of Anne Arundel County. It makes the district an even split between Republicans and Democrats almost, and brings the state's congressional delegation, you know, the map. Obviously, people vote for people, but the map would have seven districts that lean Democratic and one district that is a toss-up.
Why wasn't the legislature tougher on this and making it more Democratic? They did this in the 6th congressional district to get rid of Gilchrist, though? Can't remember his name
Roscoe
now.
Roscoe Bartlett,
another name from the past. But they got rid of him. They just simply changed the district so he could not win. So why not be tougher this time?
Yeah, I mean, they really went for it last time and succeeded. I mean, you know, that case went to federal court. It went up to the Supreme Court. It went back down. It went back up to the Supreme Court again. And the Supreme Court ultimately just decided in considering that Maryland case in conjunction with other states, which, you know, gerrymandered in favor of Republicans. So they could have really come to a middle of the line decision on partisan gerrymandering. The Supreme Court decided really not to weigh in.
It's a state issue, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, I can't say exactly why they didn't completely go for it, but there is a counterbalance in the governor's office. And, you know, the fact that Larry Hogan holds that position as a Republican, he had a commission that put forward a different plan. And I think, you know, perhaps they just didn't want all the grief. Perhaps they see that even if Representative Harris is reelected this coming election, he might not be likely to hold it for the whole 10 years that this map would be in place.
Laura Vazilla, where does redistricting stand in Virginia? And remind us how the process ended up in the hands of the state Supreme Court.
Well, voters passed a constitutional amendment that took the map drawing out of the legislature and put it into a bipartisan commission made up of legislators and members of the public, and they could not come to an agreement. The idea was that they'd come up with a map and then it would get an up or down vote in the General Assembly without any amendments to allow people to, you know, tinker with the lines. They utterly failed to come to any kind of agreement, so that threw the matter to the state Supreme Court, which hired two special masters, one Democrat, one Republican. And from there, those two people, by their own account, quite amicably carved up the state into congressional and state House and Senate districts. The most interesting aspect of it is that it drew in, when it comes to congressional districts, the Spamberger seat, the 7th district seat, was redrawn in a way that makes it lean more Democratic, but it's 50 miles away from where the current representative lives. So, and of course, you don't have to live in your district that you run in for Congress, oddly enough, but it's maybe not the greatest look. So it's unclear what will happen there as far as whether Spamberger wants to move or run in a district far away from her house or what. And in the House and Senate race districts, state House and Senate, those, in many cases, legislators are doubled or tripled up into districts. Sometimes it's the same party, two Democrats in the same district, sometimes two Republicans, sometimes one of either party.
Danielle Gaines, it's been particularly contentious, redistricting, that is, in Prince George's County, Maryland. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, this is the county council level redistricting, and there have been a few county council level redistricting fights in the state of Maryland. But in Prince George's County, you had a commission that, you know, redistricted and population changed over the past 10 years. And so they, you know, tweaked lines here and there and more or less kept the same shapes. And then the map came to the county council, and suddenly there was a new map introduced. It drew some challengers to some of the incumbents out of the districts that they planned to run in, and really solidified power, and it had a majority vote. There was, you know, a minority of the council who disagreed and attempted to make change, but they were unsuccessful.
Indeed. Martin Ostermill, redistricting in D.C. will have big impacts in some wards. What can you tell us?
I just feel it doesn't do justice to the fights you had in Virginia and Maryland. It's just not nearly that exciting because there's
been way too fair.
Right. There's no partisan control.
Well, if you live near the ballpark.
Yeah. So now the big change was basically Ward 6 was the city's biggest. It had grown the fastest over the last 10 years, so it had to lose about 20,000 people. Ward 7 and 8, majority black, majority low income, east of the Anacostia River, had to grow. So Ward 8, for the first time, jumped across the Anacostia River. Ward 7 moved further west. Again, there were some like neighborhood level fights about who wants to be in Ward 6 or who wants to be in Ward 7. But and just to tell you with the process, the biggest fight was honestly over two parcels of land between Wards 1, 4, and 5. That don't really have any residents. They're not completely empty, but they're basically empty. So that's kind of the sort of fighting we had. It wasn't over who's going to control the legislature. It's like, who's going to control that one field that no one else has?
The big thing for me in this is that Ward 8 will now include, which is the poorest ward in the city of the eight wards, will now include the fast-growing ballpark region of Southeast Washington on South Capitol Street, where the ballpark is, and all those new businesses and condos and parks. It's going to be interesting how Trayon White, who is the council member from Ward 8, will deal with this new, totally different place in his ward. I think it's going to be very interesting to watch that in 2022 as we go forward.
And just to give a sense, it's going to double the white population in Ward 8, but it's still going to be a relatively small population. It'll go from, I think, 4% to about 9%, but that's what Navy Yard is bringing because it's much whiter than Ward 8, which it's now joining.
And also, the law is you could not disrupt minority voting strength in the city. So that's was kept. But the issue is those additional 9% white voters in Ward 8, historically, they vote more than poor people do. So they could have a larger impact on any races going forward than their sheer numbers.
Martin, we've been talking about police reform legislation in Maryland, but this year, U.S. cities saw record numbers of homicides. In D.C., we saw the highest number of homicides in 16 years. What has this year been like in public safety in the district, and what initiatives have been front and center?
I mean, it's been tough. Like, it's been in a lot of cities, a lot of places across the country. We're at now 200-plus homicides. It's, like you said, it's an increase over last year, the year before that, and the highest in the last 16 years. Now, again, it's difficult. It's troubling. And the fact is that I don't think the mayor or the council, they don't have specific answers. They don't even know why it's happening. So trying to find a solution to something that you don't know why it's happening is very difficult. They're throwing money at violence interrupters. They try to throw money at hiring more police officers, but that's a very contentious issue. So now the police department is actually at its lowest staffing level in a while. So I think this is going to feed into next year. I think the debate over the mayor's budget and what she wants to do with the police department and how the council responds. Because, I mean, how much more money do you put into violence interrupters? Do you keep going down that path or do you stop at some point and say, all right, well, we're down to 3,400 police officers. 2 years ago, we were at 3,900. Do we fill that gap or do we just let it keep sliding?
The question is that we've asked Robert White, one of the candidates for mayor on this show, is what do you do? Yes, if you support every violence interruption program someone mentions, every one of them. Mm-hmm. What do you still then tell the grandmother sitting on her porch that she cannot sit on her porch because her street's too violent? There are no police officers in that neighborhood. So that's an issue the mayor feels very strongly she's going to take into the primary campaign for reelection. She says you got to have the police officers on the street good police officers, better police officers, but while you do the longer-term violence interruption stuff to get people away from crime, you've got to deal with the crime now. It's going to be a fascinating campaign fight.
Mm-hmm. Well, you and I have seen this movie before, Tom Sherwood, and we, in the
we're
past
old enough
years,
to have seen all the movies.
They've talked about community policing as an initiative. Now we're talking more and more about violence interrupters and the like, and we never seem to be able to actually pinpoint the cause of these spikes, particularly in homicide.
Well, you know, you talk to the FBI. I mean, across the country, I think homicides are up at 20 or 25%, whatever mm-hmm. the number is, in particularly in urban areas. There are shootings in suburban areas. Some people say it's just the tension of the COVID, which we haven't probably talked enough about today, just the pandemic. But I don't think anyone knows the answer. But you, if you live in a neighborhood where there's lots of crime, the people who live there tell me they would like to see more police officers in their neighborhood to respond to crime. They certainly are not the answer to crime.
Glad you mentioned COVID, Danielle. Let's talk about the ongoing pandemic, which affected the entire region. COVID-19 vaccines became available to the public earlier this year. How did Maryland Governor Larry Hogan handle the vaccine rollout?
When it came to the vaccine rollout, he was a strong proponent of getting people vaccinated early. There was not this like strife over whether to get vaccinated or not to get vaccinated. The state had a robust system. There were clinics, there were various outreach efforts to get to people where they already were. And like everywhere in America, it was rough at the very beginning. There were it was an incredible demand to get vaccinations and not enough to go around. I remember the governor saying at a press conference, yes, like everyone can criticize me right now. No one can get an appointment. A lot of lawmakers had argued for a centralized sign-up system for appointments, which, was never made available. But he did promise that at some point, there would be an inflection point where there would be plenty of vaccines for anybody who wanted to go get them. And we certainly reached that point. And Maryland has a 90% partially vaccinated rate. It's one of the best states in the country.
Laura Vazella, in Virginia, how did the COVID-19 rollout go? And how were things like stay-at-home orders and mask mandates used?
It was similar to Maryland in that, again, when the supply was low, when it was first available, there was, there were a lot more people wanting to get it than vaccine to give out. And initially they had to do these big, sites where people would have to go to a stadium and whatnot to get a vaccine. And I guess they were happy to get it any way they could. But eventually, it went quite smoothly, and the state had pretty good numbers relative to other states. However, there are some real regional differences in far southwest Virginia. Some of the reddest parts of the state are there's still a lot of reluctance to getting the vaccine. It's been very politicized, in the governor's race, I don't know that you want to go back to there or not, but that became an issue in terms of mandates, and there was a lot of opposition to requiring anybody to wear a mask or to get a vaccine, which obviously ultimately didn't hurt Glenn Youngkin.
Martin Ostermuhl here in D.C. How were COVID-19 vaccines distributed, and how were other COVID-19 measures handled by the Bowser administration and D.C. Health? What kind of equity issues have we seen?
Lots of equity issues. I mean, vaccine uptake in the minority kind of low-income neighborhoods trailed far behind, even though they were hardest hit by COVID. So it really showed that there's a challenge in communicating with communities that may not trust you. Other than that, I mean, in Virginia and Maryland, we had the same problems that Virginia and Maryland had with technological snafus to actually get appointments. I mean, this is a very type A city, so people were doing just about everything to get themselves vaccines. They were using a phone, a tablet, and a computer at the same time to try to log on to get an appointment. And that, coupled with the city's not-so-great technological infrastructure, made it really difficult on the front end. Now we're in a much better place. And if you go into a CVS, you'll get a vaccine.
If I did very briefly, last spring, we all thought we were maybe moving ahead. People were starting to be vaccinated. We thought we were going to be much better off. People started to travel again. And then the Delta virus came. And that started slowing everything down. Then people started feeling a little bit better about that. Oh, the Delta virus is still bad. And then Omicron comes along as the new variant. And we're going into 2022 with the rising expectations of cases of Omicron. And there's a great weariness now about exactly when will we see the end of this, or will we ever? Will it be like an annual flu shot?
Let's look ahead to 2022. Laura Vozzella, what will you be watching for in Virginia politics?
Well, I think it'll be really curious to see just how Glenn Youngkin governs. He definitely ran as someone who tried to be all things to all people at a lot of times. He has very much of a suburban basketball dad vibe, but he also took some fairly hard right positions. And so we'll see if he tries to pivot to the kitchen table issues. That's certainly what he's been voicing lately that he'd like to emphasize. And we'll see how that flies with some of the Republicans who are now in power in the state house. And they might want to push on all of these things and not just stick to the things that are palatable to swing voters.
Well, we know that parental involvement in school curricula and critical race theory were a big part of Youngkin's campaign. What exactly could he do on that front once he's in office?
Well, he's been saying a lot of things that he'll do on day one, including ban critical race theory. Some critics will say, well, that's easy enough to do. It's not being taught in schools as is, although if you're talking more broadly about equity work going on in school districts, I don't know that the governor actually has the power to tell school districts they can't do these things. A lot of these things are not at least widely considered things that he can do with executive power. But we will see how far he tries to push that, or if there are some, or there certainly will be House Republican support for that, and perhaps some moderate Democrats would join in. But I think he's talking a lot more these days about creating charter schools than banning CRT. So we'll see if that really remains a priority.
Danielle Gaines, Marylanders will select their governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general next year as Republican Governor Larry Hogan is term limited. What will you be watching for in that race?
Yeah, there's even greater turnover than that as well, because the comptroller seat is opening up with Comptroller Peter Franchot running for governor. And the treasurer's seat was just vacated by longtime treasurer Nancy Kopp. And attorney general is also opening up. So this is the first time in many, many decades that you have all of those kind of statewide positions opening up. So there are 8 Democratic tickets seeking the nomination. You have 2 main Republican candidates. And, you know, I think probably the Democratic field of governor candidates in Maryland would be an envy of other states. So there are a lot of qualified candidates.
Tom Sherwood, what are you looking for in that race?
Well, clearly I think the attorney general race is going to be interesting. Anthony Brown is giving up his seat in Congress, a safe seat he could keep for the rest of his life, to run for attorney general. And Ms. O'Malley, I'm blanking on her first name.
Catherine O'Malley.
Karen O'Malley. Talk about a family name in Maryland. She's running for attorney general. That's going to be a fascinating race.
Indeed. Montgomery County and Prince George's County will also be holding elections. What offices on the ballot? What are you seeing in those races so far?
Montgomery County will be interesting. You have a council and a county executive race. There are additional members to the county council, so that will add, just a lot of layers to representation and races in Montgomery County. And then you also have the county executive race, where you have the current county executive, Mark Elridge, being challenged by 2 different current county council members.
So. The more the merrier.
Martin D.C.
And others, sorry.
Martin D.C. will have elections in 2022. What are the ones you'll be watching, and who are the candidates you'll be paying the most attention to?
I mean, the big one is top of the ticket. It's the mayor's race. Mayor Bowser's running for a 3rd term. She'd be the only the second person since Barry to do that, to pull it off. If she wins, she's running against Robert White, a council member, and Trayon White, who is also a council member. And I just think, Robert White versus Muriel Bowser is kind of the top of the ticket pairing. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how that goes. I still think Mayor Bowser is a formidable candidate. She's raised a ton of money already. So that's going to be big. And then there's some council races. Phil Mendelson, long-term council chair, is taking on Aaron Palmer, who's an advisory neighborhood commissioner in Ward 4. That should be an interesting one because, again, it pits the kind of more centrist moderation of Mendelson against the more progressive, younger energy of someone like Palmer and folks in the city. So that should be fun. Yeah.
And Attorney General Carl Racine decided not to run for mayor, but I've heard a great speculation that if Robert White falters and doesn't win the June 28th primary, that Carl Racine, who still hasn't canceled out his attorney general campaign office, could run in the November election.
Ooh.
So,
well, before we wrap up, we wanted to hear from some of our more frequent guests on the show. They shared with us their New Year's resolutions for 2022. Let's take a listen.
Hi, this is Phil Mendelson, chairman of the D.C. Council.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Randall, Chair-at-Large of the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors in Loudoun County, Virginia.
Hi, this is County Executive Mark Elrich.
This is Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks.
Matt DeFranti, Arlington County Chair.
I'm Justin Wilson, Mayor of the City of Alexandria, Virginia.
I'm Jeff McKay, Chairman of the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors.
Oh, this is Galvin Hawkins, Chair of the Prince George's County Council.
My New Year's resolution for the District of Columbia is to achieve better public education for our children, especially children considered to be at risk.
My New Year's resolution is to become conversational in Spanish by the end of next year.
My New Year's resolution is to visit a barbecue shop every week and to learn how to play 3 45-minute sets of songs on my guitar.
My 2022 resolution is to have a strong finish to my first term in office, stay connected to my favorites, Prince George's, and of course, you know I'm going to have to get in a line dance with our sassy seniors.
I resolve to be the board member my dog Zoe appears to believe that I am. And, on a more serious note, to work on economic and racial equity to help make Arlington the beloved community that Dr. King envisioned.
My 2022 New Year's resolution is to make up for lost time, travel more, eat more good food, sleep more, exercise more, and laugh a heck of a lot more.
My New Year's resolution as we emerge from the pandemic is to safely eat in more of our local restaurants as opposed to having to scarf food down in my car or in a parking lot of a restaurant.
My resolution for 2022 is to fully embrace all of life's blessings. Sometimes we move about at warp speed and miss the simple joys of daily living. So my pace might shift in 2022, but I don't intend to miss a single beat.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Have a happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Well, we'll be sure to follow up on all of those ambitious resolutions when we have them next as guests on the Politics Hour. But it's only fair that if we made them share their resolutions, we make you do it too. So, Danielle Gaines, I'll start with you. What's your resolution for the new year?
Nothing like being on the spot. Well, after listening to that, I feel like I should give like the politician's answer of like, I would like to double donations to Maryland Matters. I think, but really, I'd like to get home and to be settled more frequently and have dinner with my daughter and husband.
Laura Vazella, what's your resolution for 2022?
I would like to not give up on running and swimming, even when the General Assembly is in session.
I'll cheer for you.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Martin Ostermue.
Professionally, I need to stop doom scrolling on Twitter. It's been since the pandemic, there's just too much bad news that comes across too quickly and it drives me and my family crazy. So I got to stop that. And on a personal level, I want to ride my bike across the Commonwealth of Virginia. There's a really cool path from DC basically all the way to the southwestern corner. It's about 500 some odd miles and I'd love to get it done. My wife and children permitting.
And he's been scrolling through Twitter even during this broadcast, but that's a whole nother story. You're not off the hook for this one, Tom Sherwood. Do you have a New Year's resolution?
I do. You know, my one is that the regional politics remains interesting enough that we can have it on the Politics Hour, but my New Year's resolution is more of a wish. I wish that as we ring in the new year, we wring out all the poison politics over the COVID virus and the infections. People are still dying and the crisis is far from over. We should all resolve to take it more seriously and help each other rather than turning on each other.
That's very commendable. I do have two New Year's resolutions. One of them is that when you get to my stage of life, the first is to wake up every morning. And the second resolution is to make sure that Tom Sherwood never uses the phrase QAnon whack job on this show again.
Once a week, the whole year.
And that's about all the time we have. Martin Ostermuhl is a reporter for WAMU and DCS. Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Laura Vazella is a reporter covering Virginia politics for The Washington Post. Laura, thank you for joining us. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
And Danielle Gaines is the editor-in-chief of Maryland Matters. Danielle, thank you and Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. It was good to see everyone.
Tom Sherwood, what's your New Year plans? New Year's Eve plans?
To be the same grumpy person that I've been in 2021.
I'll drink to that. I'll do the same. And thank you all for listening. We'll see you in 2022. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Nandi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schrobsdorf. Our phone screener is Bruce Romer. Mike Kidd engineered this show, and a special thank you to Kellen Quigley for his help with mixing and editing. Mona Cashby oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows, visit thepoliticshour.org.